stay the course. We are dead. We are all dead.
We're supposed to make the world a better place. Well,
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I know Kung Fu.
You either die a hero, or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
This whole thing is insane. This whole thing is insane.
300 years ago, you'd have been burned at the stake.
What do all men of power want? More power.
This is now the United States of Zombieland.
This whole thing is insane.
Man is evil, capable of nothing but destruction.
Everybody is stuck with the things that they're not proud of.
More power.
Welcome to the desert of the real.
More power.
There can be only one.
Are you a God-fearing man, Senator? That's such a strange phrase. I've always thought of God as a teacher, as a bringer of light, wisdom, and understanding. You see, I think what you really are afraid of is me.
Happy heresies, and welcome to the desert of the real. Heresy shouldn't be this much fun, but it is. It just is. Especially when you get the audio version of AB Live. This one, episode 53. Raw and censored and unfiltered. Just like the truth you've been looking for across all your existences. Supercharged by stellar audience participation. Robert Sullivan returned to the virtual Alexandria to discuss his latest book from his lauded Cinema Symbolism series. We went underneath so many esoteric hoods to contemplate synchromysticism, social engineering, occult casting, and predictive programming in movies. We covered culture-changing films like Joker, Dark City, The Shape of Water, Pan's Labyrinth, and more, as well as the TV series Twin Peaks. From Gnosticism to Freemasonry to Black Magic and Kabbalah, no occult rock was left unturned. As a bonus for patrons, Red Circle members, and AB Prime members, I'll include a section from our last Cinema Symbolism interview, where Robert took a deep dive into David Lynch, from his philosophy to his cinematic style. We also covered V for Vendetta and From Hell, as well as other Alan Moore films, and Freemason themes in Hollywood movies, and much more. Perfect compliment, and you won't want to miss it. I'm so grateful to those of you who support this Red Pill Cafeteria, and I hope I have been a good servant of Sophia to you. Your support and company keep me going. Don't forget the Finding Hermes program and my voiceover availability. Whether it's an audiobook, commercial, podcast intro, or an audio broadcast to another planet, I can bring starry results to your project. Please remember too, you can now tip via Stripe, since many of you use it, found in the show notes of any audio podcast. And you can join the simple but effective Red Circle RSS feed that works in the podcast provider of your choice. We need Gnosis more than ever, needless to say. You won't find this high-quality Gnostic and Hermetic wisdom or guests and their unique insights anywhere else in cyberspace or even meat space. But enough of my short drivel. Let us to our latest AB Live.
First, there was darkness. Then came the strangers. They were a race as old as time itself. They had mastered the ultimate technology, the ability to alter physical reality by will alone. They called this ability tuning. But they were dying. Their civilization was in decline. And so they abandoned their world, seeking a cure for their own mortality. Their endless journey brought them to a small blue world in the farthest corner of the galaxy. Our world. Here they thought they had finally found what they had been searching for.
Once again, here we are at the end of the world, or perhaps at the tangential universe, as we will be discussing tonight. And this is very excited to have this show, as we have a guest who is truly a friend of the Gnostics, an expert in occultism, great taste in movies, and an eye for all the men behind the curtain of movies. And that is Robert Sullivan, who arrives to the virtual Alexandria again to discuss his new book, or in his latest book in his series, Cinema Symbolism. Robert, thanks for coming by again.
Well, thank you, Miguel. Thank you, Fance, for having me on, rejoining you in the virtual Alexandria. It's my pleasure to be here. Yeah, I guess this is what, about my sixth or seventh time. I feel like I say this, it's cliche. I say it at the start of every show. I feel like a regular now. So it's always great to be back. And I look forward very much to the show.
Yeah, mi heretical casa is tu heretical casa, my friend. So always good to have you there. And like we were talking before, this is, I feel, is your best cinema symbolism book. And I hate to use the word flows better, the cliche of writers, but this one flows better. It's tighter. You really hit a lot of great dimensions in movie and are able to tie it into other movies as the book progresses. There's a grand narrative in your introduction on all the different things or powers behind movies is excellent. And I would tell the audience too, just this chapter on Gnostic cinema is worth the price. Excellent book. Robert ties in not just what is, he doesn't just talk about what is Gnostic cinema, but he ties each of the movies to a different thinker, Valentinus, Basilides, so forth. And I know you've done it in your other books, but this one you really upgraded. So good job, Robert.
Well, thank you, Miguel. That's high praise. I really appreciate it. I was really pleased with the way the book came out. I did give it a little more TLC this time, and I think it was worth the wait. The payoff was worth it. One of the things, I was on another show, and I'll mention it briefly here, was the book was actually done at one point, or was nearing completion, and I believe this was at the end of 2019 and the very early stages of 2020, January of 2020, and there were two movies that were recently released on Blu-ray, and I was very eager to see them, and it was Joker and Midsommar, and I just watched both of them, and I was blown away, and I thought, wait a minute, time out. Let's pump the brakes here. I thought there's just so much going on in both those movies. I basically literally stopped the process of the book. And I thought I have to include these movies. They're just too important. There's just too much going on. And, that did delay it. And I don't regret doing it. I think it was worth it. And you mentioned the flow of the book. It's one of the things I'm doing right now is I'm actually going back and looking at my other four books, and I'm actually retweaking them a little bit. There's some parts of it that I don't like. There's some parts of it I do like very much, but I am going back and doing some edits on some of my earlier books. So that'll be happening in the next year or two. I'll be releasing, it's not going to be a third edition or a second edition. It's just going to revise the editions that are currently released. But no, I appreciate your praise. I really do, especially coming from you. And like I said, it was a lot of hard work, and I'm happy with the way it came out as well.
Awesome. Yeah, I can always tell how good a book is by me not wanting to put it down and losing sleep and cursing myself, but it was worth the rush of a good book or movie or novel. You're like, fuck it. But and this one had me. Again, your chapters on Midsommar, The Shape of Water and so forth, Joker. I just couldn't put it down. And we definitely want to talk about these movies, especially Joker was more than a movie. It's a cultural event. And
sure,
we agree it sort of presaged what was going to the disaster that was 2020. But first, I want to, of course, we got to talk about who else is here. You know, he was born a pauper to a pawn on a Christmas day when the New York Times said God is dead. He's got to be Levon. No, it's not Levon. It's Vance the Moondog. Vance, thanks for joining us. Oh, yes, always, I've been listening to Elton John today.
I guess you have. More like Rocket Man, right?
Yeah, it's always Rocket Man at the Virtual That's Alexandria. So. That is true. So awesome. Let's see, as people start going into the rooms, into the YouTube and the Facebook comments, as always, you guys probably know the rules. If you have questions for Rob, please put them in all caps or many questions. Those of you who do the donation, the super chats will immediately get put to the top. I'm going to also put here is some of the movies that we covered. So if you want to ask a question, you can ask a question of one of these movies and we're not all over the place. Of course, if you read Robert's past books, feel free to bring up one of the movies he's covered in the past. But those are
Twink Pete. Some of them. Is that a Disney version? Twink Pete's?
I screwed up that too. Twinkie Pete. Yes, exactly. It's I better change that. But little house cleaning here. What was I going to say? A lot going on. For you in the audience, one thing we're going to do is for those of you in the AB Prime subscription, we're going to change our password this month, something we rarely do. So Vance and I will get in our Mad Max cage and decide what's going to be the new password. So please check back, but please keep in mind there is going to be a new password. Other than that, we've got some exciting shows coming up in the future for you. We're going to have an AB Live with Micah Dank on the astrotheology of the Book of Enoch and the Book of Revelation. We'll have a summer special with some scholars on understanding the Gnostics, two experts on Gnosticism, sort of a summer special on Gnosticism. We'll have a Finding Hermes on evil pharma and holistic alternatives. And eventually towards the end of summer, Chris Knows is going to join us to talk about the Gnosis of Jack Kirby and graphic novels. So a lot going on, and I really appreciate your support, those of you who make it happen. And of course, love your support. I should mention too that there are other alternatives that you can support Aeon Byte. Let me put it on the screen here. I'm now on Rockfin, and that's a subscription service where you get not just full shows for Aeon Byte, but a ton of other people, very varied in their extra content, from Jimmy Dore to Jay Dyer. It's just Rockfin is a great place for censorship-free if you want to support with crypto. It's been successful. In one month, I've gone from 400 subscribers to more than 5,000. So it's exploding on Rockfin. You've also got Odyssey 2, which is another favorite for those who are seeking to support with crypto and who want to be in a place that is not run by corporate overlords. So that's some of the house cleaning I've got for now. There'll be more, but let's get back to Rob. I guess we should start with The Joker. Again, this is a movie that came out in October 2019. Seemed like a different world, but this movie was not just a movie. It really was a cultural event. It was a giant mirror in the face of society. And in a way, like what you say in your book, and I'm saying, it sort of really predicted how dysfunctional society would become or is. So let us know your thoughts on Joker, Rob.
Right. Well, I think you said it as well as I could. I mean, the movie, I really like, I mean, if you just strip away and don't talk about the symbolism, I just thought the movie was outstanding anyway. I mean, it's no wonder he, you know, won the actor for you know, with the Oscars. And I just really liked how they tied in a lot of the Batman mythology to it. It was kind of, you know, went under the radar. I mean, you have the posters in the Ha-Ha's Club for Amusement Mile. And if you're familiar with the Batman mythology, of course, that's one of the Joker's hangouts, you know, later on. When they go to Wayne Manor, you know, and the Bruce Wayne is a kid, of course, he slides down the pole. I mean, you can't help but think of the old Adam West TV show. So it's just little things like that I liked. But then, yeah, you get really into a lot of the darker symbolism of the movie. I mean, you know, you do have this alchemical theme, you know, that these movie makers really like to play around with, was the transition of the character from one thing to another. In this case, you know, you got the failed comic to the criminal psychopath. You've got the acting, you know, the actor in it, Robert De Niro, which is clearly designed to conjure two previous Martin Scorsese movies. I mean, this is like a, you know, I call it a cult casting. You know, it's really, I've kind of evolved on this, and it's really, to me, something coming out of the world of hermeticism. I mean, it's like, you know, an art of memory technique. You know, this is clearly designed to conjure the King of Comedy and Taxi Driver. I mean, that's irrefutable. Mm-hmm. And then you get, you know, I mean, it's a very dark movie. I mean, my God, the face paint is based on John Wayne Gacy, you know, Pogo the Clown, the child murderer. And then the music when he's dancing down the steps is Gary Glitter. I mean, that was a pedophile that he's rocking out to. And then you're right. I mean, the whole thing just sort of presages, you know, kind of predicts this whole dysfunctionality with the George Floyd murder, the riots, the burning down of everything, the tearing down of society. I mean, you have the Thomas Wayne character who is clearly meant to be a Donald Trump analog. That's, again, you know, stands out like a sore thumb. And again, this was a movie, like I said at the beginning, where the book was pretty much complete. You know, I was working on the conclusion of it, and it's probably, you know, like January 2nd, 2020. And I'm looking at these two Blu-rays I got for Christmas. You know, I think I got Midsommar for Christmas. I think I bought Joker soon thereafter. I'm looking at them. I'm thinking, oh, let me go watch these movies. You know, I'm watching, my jaw's hitting the ground. I thought, oh, wait a minute, you know, time out. You know, let me just, you know, stop what I'm doing. And I just knew I had to include those two movies in the book. And I, like you said, there's just so much going on in both those movies. I mean, it's a very detailed analysis, to say the least.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, it does, you say in your book, it's a slam against wokeness, but it's very multidimensional. It does show
a
very important, it's a treatise on how we've all been screwed. I mean, and all of us, if you watch the movie, honestly can understand what part of the middle class, the lower classes and all that have been screwed by the elite. For example, when Joker gets his therapist, he can't see his therapist anymore. I know somebody who's embedded in AA and others for years. It doesn't matter who the president is or the administration, right? Psychiatry and rehab money from the government is getting cut. It's like a frog in boiling water, which is the theme of the movie, is that everybody's getting screwed over, and you wonder when we will hit that boiling point.
Oh, I agree. And it is a slap in the face of the woke culture. You know, there was this sense that the Arthur Fleck character was this raging white male, the Donald Trump supporter who was, you know, trying to tear down society. You know, he's racist and this and that. But it's like, wait a minute, you know, he kills only white people in the movie, and he's in love with an African-American woman. So, you know, tell me again how this is racist. I really did believe it was sort of a slap in the face, you know, of wokeness, as it were. And there, you know, it's funny because I actually kind of contemplated whenever there's a political dimension to a film, I'm always somewhat hesitant to talk about it, because you're always, you know, it's the old line. You're always going to wind up offending half your audience. Of course, if it's an older movie like The Wizard of Oz, you know, it's William McKinley and William Jennings Bryan, you know, no one cares. And I kind of almost hesitated to put this in. And as you know, if you've read the book, and I know you have, you know, there's some stuff about Donald Trump in there. Also, some of the strange, you know, coincidences that surround him. And I hedged to whether to put this in. And there's always something with me. And this is just the way I write. And this has happened in all my other books, so Royal Archer, whatever. You know, whenever there's a sort of voice in my head telling me, oh, don't put this in, this could wind up offending somebody, or don't do it, that's kind of like my clear cut signal that yes, it has to go in. Yes, it has to go into the book. So that's why I put that stuff in. But yeah, I mean, it is. If you look at Joker, like, you know, what was it, October 19, 2019? It is. It's almost like a roadmap for what was to come. I mean, I think it's strange, to say the least.
I would say so too, and I love how you caught who is inspiration, part of how he wakes up. Her name is, of course, Sophie Dumond or something like that. So you have the Sophianic character, and then you've got,
oh, right.
Joker, who would you say? But Joker, from Heath Ledger to Jack Nicholson, is such a fascinating anti-hero. And perhaps, how do you see the Joker?
Yeah, I mean, it is. He's probably one of the greatest, like you said, anti-heroes of all time. I guess he ranks up there with Hannibal Lecter, I suppose. You know, when you look at it, if you look at it now in perspective, looking back, in my opinion, this is just Robert Sullivan speaking here. I mean, just my take on it. I saw Batman 89 in the theater, and I think I saw it like the first day it was out, and I love the movie. That movie is so dated now. The Nicholson Joker, in my opinion, resembles more of the Cesar Romero Joker, more of just like the buffoon type thing, you know, the buffoon character. The crime lord, but he's a buffoon. The one that I think really hit the grand slam with the Joker, the Joaquin Phoenix Joker, is fantastic. The Heath Ledger one is my favorite. I don't think that will change. I mean, because that is just, you know, that's just the straight, you know, anarchy, psychotic Joker who doesn't, doesn't give a fuck about anything, even his own self. Just doesn't care. And that's the way the Joker is. I mean, you know, he doesn't care about anyone, anything. You know, it's the devil Mercurius, as it were. And then there's the other one, the Jared Leto one from Suicide Squad. I mean, that's okay. It's an admirable turn in. I mean, kind of forgettable. So in my opinion, the two Jokers that really stand out are the Joaquin Phoenix one. I don't think it's fair to compare them because they're two different movies. But the Heath Ledger and the Joaquin Phoenix ones, in my opinion, are the two best ones. I like the Nicholson Joker, but again, I think it's dated. And when you watch that movie now, it definitely, at least in my eyes, resembles more of the old Batman TV show with Adam West, than the cutting edge of today.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the Nicholson one hasn't aged well. And no. I like the anarchist trickster archetype that basically forces us to look at ourselves as more cathartic. And again, it really is our shadow coming out to play. And that's why we love him. I know Heath Ledger, he based it a lot on Malcolm McDowell from A Clockwork Orange and other characters. So.
Yeah, I mean,
you know who Joaquin Phoenix? Who did he? Did he ever give a hint who he was trying to? Who he's inspired by or anything?
I know that he based his dance on the Ray Bolger Ray Bolger's dance, the Scarecrow from The Wizard of Oz. I thought that was pretty interesting. I thought that the Joker character that Phoenix is playing, the one that it reminded me of the most from the source material, was the Killing Joke comic by Alan Moore. We had the origin story of the failed comic that comes straight from the world of Alan Moore, you know, the Killing Joke, I mean, which is a classic. That to me was the angle the filmmakers were going for. I thought it was just, you know, the down and out loser, you know, figure. It reminded me, I mean, a lot. I mean, again, I draw a parallel, and people have already, I haven't seen the movie yet, but they say the Cruella movie sort of runs parallel with the Joker. Kind of reverse, where it's the female. And I thought the Joker movie with Joaquin Phoenix ran parallel to Black Swan. If you look at those two, there's a lot of similarities. Kind of the failed, frustrating artist living at home with the mother, the parental figure can't go anywhere, and eventually descends into total psychosis. So you will see the parallel with Joker and Black Swan. I haven't seen Cruella yet. I'm most anxious to see it. From what I've read a little bit online, that the Cruella movie kind of parodies the Joker movie with Joaquin Phoenix. So I'll have to see it. I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome. Yeah, I haven't heard anything like that. And what do you think about Hollywood right now? Obviously, the pandemic and the lockdowns really shut things down, movie theaters, and everybody has shifted towards streaming and wondering, are people going to go back? Even there was a story today, Barry Diller, the great Hollywood mogul, said the ticket business is dead. I don't know if he meant the movie business, but he said getting people into the seats is over. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on this, Rob?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was looking at the box office recently of two movies. It was just out of curiosity, it was just to see what was going on. And it was A Quiet Place 2 and Cruella, and they both looked like they were doing extremely well at the box office. I know what you're saying, though, about things like Netflix. I think a few movies debuted. I know a few studios kind of gave up and were tired of waiting around. I know the one that was released, you know, there's Disney Plus, and I lose track of all of them, but the one, the Roald Dahl, The Witches, which was originally an Angelica Houston movie that came out in the early 90s, Dahl hated it. There's a funny story with that, but they remade it with Anne Hathaway, which was originally supposed to go into the theater, but I think they just released it on some streaming, you know, network.
I'm
behind the times on this, but they just released it on TV or like some subscription based, you know, streaming network. But I was looking at the box office of A Quiet Place 2 and Cruella. It looks like they were doing worldwide very, very well. I think the movie theater business, just with the theater, will come back. The one that I just saw that I was, you know, kind of blown away by, some guy in an AMC theater bootlegged it. He filmed it with his phone and he put it up on YouTube. And when Blumhouse and Universal saw it, they were just like, screw it, you know, let's just drop the trailer. And this was for the new Halloween movie, Halloween Kills, which is the sequel to the Halloween 2018, which I loved. I thought that movie was just fantastic. It blew me away. And when I watched the trailer for Halloween Kills, I mean, I just got to see this thing. I mean, it just looked absolutely fantastic. So, you know, is it dead? No, I wouldn't go that far. Maybe it'll take a little longer to come around. I mean, I know Halloween Kills was slated for a 2020 release. Of course, that didn't happen because of the pandemic.
Right.
But I'm looking forward to seeing that. And of course, you know, the studios, you know, they're not hurting for money. None of them are. I mean, you get into, you know, when it's released on cable or, you know, the Blu-ray or DVD, they make money on that. So, I mean, I don't think Hollywood personally is going to be filing, you know, Warner Brothers, Disney. I don't think they'll be filing bankruptcies anytime soon. But, you know, yeah, could the method of seeing the movie change or, you know, maybe evolve a little bit? Yeah, I guess it could. The one thing I've noticed on my end, I'm here in Baltimore, is the one thing, I mean, this is just, again, me, Rob Sullivan, speaking just from my own experience and just from, you know, being out, is people are anxious to go back. You know, people are wanting to get out of their houses. People are wanting to go on vacation. People are wanting to go back. I was talking to a buddy that I work with, and he said it was just an average Monday. He said he was up at the shopping mall. He said it looked like Christmas Eve. He said it was wall to wall. He couldn't believe it. So I think there is a sense of people kind of wanting to return to a sense of normalcy after this thing. So, in my opinion, I think the movie theaters will start filling up again. And like I said, you know, I was looking at the box office for those two movies, and they didn't seem to be hurting, to say the least.
Yeah, but even then, I think the problem I feel, and of course, maybe I'm finally getting too old, the Who is mocking me somewhere in the 60s, but the movies, I think, are just so shitty. I mean, I have not enjoyed any movie. I think the two movies I've liked in the last few years have both... have been with Nicolas Cage, of all people. Ironic, right? The goofy 80s, 90s actor, and that was Mandy and Color Out of Space. But these movies are just, I feel they're getting worse and worse. It's hard to find good fare. What do you think, Rob?
Yeah, I like...
You get probably people, you probably have a fan base as, like, you know, people who like occultism and Freemasonry, so they're like, check this one out, Rob. So it might be easier for you.
I like some of the movies that have been released of late. I loved the two Ari Aster movies, Hereditary and Midsommar. I thought they were very good. I like Joker. I thought that was very good. I like the Halloween 2018. I mean, it's a slasher horror movie. It's not anything deep, but I thought it was entertaining. I liked it. I liked the way they kind of played around with, you know, I felt like I was watching like a Mandela Effect movie almost, where you had these bleeding timelines. I mean, the Halloween franchise just loves erasing one timeline after another after another. And then, of course, you have the standalone Halloween 3, which is kind of like in its own universe. And I really liked how the Halloween 18 movie kind of had all these bleeding through. You had Halloween 2, Halloween 4, Halloween 3. You know, kind of like bleeding through. It was like almost like a Mandela Effect movie. I thought that worked with great effect. But, you know, it's funny. I always find myself, if I'm just sitting around bored or writing or you know, editing or whatever, and I want to watch a movie, I always do find myself kind of putting on, for whatever reason, like the old Universal horror movies, you know, from the 30s and 40s. I very seldom, I like the modern movies, and I do watch them for when I analyze them, of course. But I always find myself going back to, like, you know, Dracula or The Wolfman or House of Frankenstein or movies like that. Those are ones that always, I guess, just part of my childhood watching them, you know, when I was a kid on, like, you know, Saturday night at 10 o'clock, you know, pre age of video, you know, and this was the only way you could watch them was on, you know, Chiller Theater and things like that. The one in Baltimore was called The Ghost Host. And if you wanted to watch, you know, again, this was pre-video. So if you wanted to watch these old Universal horror movies, you know, this was it. So I always find myself turning back to those. But no, I do like the films of Ari Aster. And I did like the Halloween. And like I said, I am looking forward to seeing the Cruella movie. But, that's just my taste. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder, as it were.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I just can't handle them. Something's changed with me. And yeah, I see. Rhyme in the chat. What about Parasite? Parasite was pretty good. Again, it's kind of like Joker. It came out right before the world went completely mad and closed down again. And it's a very good class warfare movie. So I enjoyed it. So awesome. And you just talked about occult casting. In our last interview, we did talk about subliminal messaging, social engineering, all that stuff. But what is occult casting, Rob?
Yeah, this is an interesting phenomenon. And this is definitely something that these filmmakers like to do. And this is, I call it occult casting. It's just a term that I coined. I view it now as more of a art of memory mnemonic. That's the way I now view it. And that's where these filmmakers will cast an actor or an actress and place them in a film to conjure another performance. And by doing so, kind of invest the new movie with the vibe of that old movie. We talked about, I mean, like I said, the one that stands out like a sore thumb is Robert De Niro in Joker. This is clearly designed to conjure the King of Comedy, where he played a Arthur Fleck analog named Rupert Pumpkin, I believe his name was. And it's the same sort of character. You know, he has delusions being this famous comedian, and he winds up kidnapping the host, which I believe was Jerry Lewis, and holding him hostage. And then, of course, Taxi Driver with the whole, you know, psychological meltdown, which is, of course, Travis Bickle, and this is what Arthur Fleck undergoes. And again, you know, it's one of the movies that stood out to me when I first noticed it was the Max von Sydow casting in Star Wars: The Force Awakens. I guess this is Episode 7, I suppose, where von Sydow just turns up very briefly at the beginning of this movie. And I always kind of thought to myself, well, why did they hire von Sydow for this? You know, they could have put anyone in there. And then it struck me like a ton of bricks. I thought, no, they couldn't have put anyone in there because this is designed to conjure two other movies that von Sydow was in. And if you've seen The Force Awakens, the movie opens on the desert planet, and von Sydow plays this sort of sadistic, you know, recluse hermit, as it were. And he confronts this dark evil lord, Kylo Ren, and he gets struck down. And the two movies that I immediately jumped into my head, it was, oh, this is a retelling of Dune. Where von Sydow plays the hermit character on Arrakis, and he gets struck down by Baron Hakonnen, I think it is. Right. So it's kind of like a transfer, where Kylo Ren now becomes this Baron Harkonnen savage type figure, and von Sydow is again the hermit who gets killed. And of course, the other one is The Exorcist, again in the desert, confronts the evil statue of Pazuzu, and you know, it's like investing the First Order and Kylo with this evil presence, as it were. And the filmmakers are very good with this. You got De Niro, you got von Sydow, the one, oh God, what's the actor's name in The Matrix, in the sequel? What's his name? He played the newscaster in the Omega Man. Its name's escaping me. And he gives the same speech. Yeah, he gives the same speech to Neo that he gives in the Omega Man, only it's reversed. Where he's saying, talking about, you know, protecting mankind, and then the Omega Man, it's destroying mankind. And I immediately recognized it. I thought, oh, this
they're
is
both kind of Luddites. Yeah, they're both characters are Luddites. They want to destroy. They're very wary of technology. Yeah, good point. Good eye.
Yeah, I forget the actor's name. Anthony Zerbe. That's it. It's Anthony Zerbe. He plays Matthias in the Omega Man, and I forget the name of his the character in The Matrix Reloaded. One of the councilman something or another. It escapes me. But the two characters run parallel. And it was clearly designed, like you said, to conjure this Luddite vibe from the Omega Man and put it into the Matrix, at least its sequel. So this is what a cult casting is. And it's an interesting study. And like I said, in my opinion, I think it when I first started talking about this in the second movie book, and by the time I got finished up the third one, my opinion, like I said, had kind of evolved on it, where to me, this is really coming out of the world of Hermeticism. I think of Giordano Bruno and Raymond Lully with The Art of Memory. And that's what this really seems more akin to me, is placing these there. And, you know, it's designed to evoke a memory of some kind. And in this case, what the previous actor's baggage is from another film. And it works quite effectively. At least I think it does.
Yeah, and it must not be easy because, and as you talk in cinema symbolism, not you have occult casting, you've got synchromysticism, there could be predictive programming, it could just be trolling from the writers and the director. Here's an Easter egg. Yeah, so you have always this constellation of wonder of symbols in every movie, and you really can't really pin it down. Like, for example, Stanley Kubrick, there's always something about pedophilia in all of his movies, pretty much, from The Shining to Lolita. But we don't know if he's warning us, if he's mocking us, is he into it? We just have to kind of, as a researcher, right, Rob? You just kind of have to, here's the evidence, and I can't come to a conclusion.
Yeah, it's me being a lawyer. I mean, I present the evidence, and you decide. I view my reader as a jury, and I present the evidence, and I let you decide. I mean, I think that if you watch Lolita, at the one movie he hated that he disowned was Spartacus. That was the only movie he disowned. And there is a scene at the beginning of Lolita where the Peter Sellers character, Quilty, mocks it. And I always thought that scene in The Shining where Jack Nicholson has the male porno mag, Playgirl, I always thought that was a tongue-in-cheek mocking of Spartacus by Kubrick, because the one scene that he wanted in, this is the infamous snails and oysters scene, between Laurence Olivier and Tony Curtis, this homoerotic scene in Spartacus that was cut out. And I think it irked Kubrick to no end, where Tony Curtis is giving Laurence Olivier a bath in a Roman spa. And he talks about snails and oysters. And you see where the conversation's going, of course. And Tony Curtis is calling Laurence Olivier master through the entire, scene. Yeah, yeah. And, Kubrick does that. He puts these little tongue-in-cheek, Easter eggs, if you want, in his cinema. I mean, they're all over the damn place. And like you said, it's what is what. I was watching a movie on Blu-ray called Piercing. It was a movie that was released in 2018. It's about sadomasochism. It stars Mia Wasikowska. And it harkens back to this movie she made a few years earlier called Stoker. And she wears this, she has a fetish in this movie for black and white saddle shoes. And when you watch Piercing, here she comes into the room wearing what else but black and white high-heeled shoes. And I thought, oh, here we go again. Here they're hearkening back to this other movie that she made. I put it in there, and I kind of leave it up to the reader to decide, is it good? Is it evil? Is it manipulation? Is it tongue-in-cheek? Is it mind control? I view myself,
You also mentioned movies that predicted 9/11. You don't leave anything. You say these movies we know predicted 9/11, from Fight Club to The Matrix to so many others. So you do put out, this could easily all be supernatural, Jungian unconscious kind of
stuff. Sure. It could be that, or it could be intentional. I mean, the one thing, and this is something you'll appreciate, is you do have, and whether you call it synchronicity, the collective unconscious, from about 1997 to about 2002, you have this rash of Gnostic movies released. I mean, this is the ones we always talk about are released from 97 to 02, The Matrix, Truman Show, Vanilla Sky, Existenz.
13th Floor. Yeah, you cover all these.
13th Floor, Donnie Darko, they all come out in this 5-year time frame, and they all reflect 9/11. I don't know why. I don't know what this is about, but each one of those movies, in some form or fashion, Vanilla Sky, The Matrix, Donnie Darko, all seem to talk about 9/11. They put it in. I mean, and then you get into the synchronicity of this thing. And this is something else I found out. You get the release of the movies. I mean, Fight Club came out like September 21st, 1999. I mean, there's almost 2 years to the day. The Simpsons episode with Bart where he waves the money in front of the 9/11 magazine. I mean, this is like September 21st, 1997, 2 years earlier. So, I mean, you had this like roadmap going almost right to the date of this thing. Where, you know, this imagery in popular culture, this pre-9/11 imagery is popping up. I don't try to explain it. I just put it in. The most, you know, the one thing I always turn to was the world of Carl Jung. We get into the works of Emanuel Swedenborg, you know, using, you know, dream vision, prophecy, the artistic expression as prophetic, transcendent, as it were. I mean, this comes out of the world of Platonism. So, you know, that's kind of where this path has led me to. Could it be intentional and Hollywood filmmakers are privy to, you know, some sort of secret information? Yeah, of course. I mean, as I mentioned in the books, I mean, you have Yankee Doodle Dandy that was war propaganda. The first couple of the Basil Rathbone, you know, not Universal Sherlock Holmes movies with Nigel Bruce, not the 20th Century Fox ones, but the first ones, couple he made for Universal, they're all war propaganda. The FBI reviewed the scripts of the X-Files. So, yeah, I mean, of course, you know, you always got to take that into consideration.
Yeah. And, again, you have such a great eyesight. Yes, I agree with you. There was something going on. Maybe it was the change of the millennium. Maybe it was the deep state was bringing down the hammer and people were just having more gnosis. Maybe we were having a Gnostic awakening and they had to shut us down with Iraq and 9/11, you know what I mean? The terrible beginning of the shitty beginning of the 21st century, which we haven't recovered in style and music. And it's just been a disaster. But you always bring us some good points, like Donnie Darko, one of the great Gnostic films of all times. I've broken this movie down, and I'm glad you explained perfectly the science of the tangential universe and what Donnie Darko, he's the Gnostic savior with it. But I didn't know. At the Halloween party, his sister Elizabeth, you caught she's dressed as someone from the movie Lolita, which brings a new wrinkle to
the. Yeah, right. She's well. The whole this is again this pedophile theme into this. I mean, for starters, just let me take a quick time out here. If anyone hasn't seen Donnie Darko, it's a fantastic movie. I absolutely love it. I found some parallels with my own life in it, believe it or not. But I'm going to leave that aside. If you have not seen the movie, by all means, watch the director's cut. Get the director's cut and with the pages from the time book in it that Roberta Sparrow wrote. That will help explain the movie so much more than the theatrical version. If you've seen the theatrical version, you liked it, which I have both of them here. I have both of them on Blu-ray. By all means, I cannot stress it enough, get the director's cut. It is fantastic. It's a phenomenal movie. I absolutely love it. The character that Maggie Gyllenhaal plays, this is his sister Elizabeth, at the Halloween party, she's dressed as Vivian Darkbloom. This is Peter Sellers' hatchet woman from Lolita. And of course, you just got right off the bat the parallel with the names. I mean, Darkbloom, Darko. And in Donnie Darko, there is a deep pedophilic theme with the Cunningham character. This is the Patrick Swayze, JC. Jesus Christ. I mean, this tells you what Richard Kelly thinks of Christianity. I mean, even when Swayze's introduced in the film, for Christ's sake, he blonde hair, blue eyes in front of the rising sun on the golf course. I mean, do I have to get any more Neoplatonic than that? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in of course, with Lolita, it's all about, I guess the proper word is a hebephile, probably maybe better than a pedophile. So you have Richard Kelly linking those two movies, Lolita with Kubrick and his film Donnie Darko. The one thing that I picked up on with this, with these Hollywood filmmakers today is they love Kubrick. I mean, they love Kubrick. I mean, any chance one of these modern filmmakers gets to pay an homage to Kubrick, I don't know why. I mean, he's a great filmmaker, granted, but they just love paying tribute to Kubrick. And that's one with Richard Kelly with the sister dressed as Vivian Darkbloom in Lolita.
Yeah, what a great coincidence. We've got Robert Sullivan tonight, Cinema Symbolism and AB Live. I hope you are enjoying it. And Vance, Do you have any questions or questions from the audience or comments on any Gnostic movies?
Well, we got one question from our friend, Mr. Umas. And what's the best movie to watch with Enochian script subtitles?
The best one to watch with Enochian script subtitles, The Witch with Roger Eggers. The chanting at the end is Enochian. So you want to watch the Witch for Enochian script.
And here's my question. What does Twin Peaks mean?
Yeah, well, where do you want to start?
I've been very much into it.
You know, we could do a whole show on Twin Peaks. I mean,
oh, I know. Already,
you know, I mean, I think Twin Peaks takes up, I don't know how many pages of the book, but I mean, that is just such a deep study. You know, I mean, when you're dealing with Lynch, I mean, you're always dealing with duality. I mean, that's the one thing that really, you know, he enjoys more than anything else is duality, doubles. I mean, that's all he.
Or triality, because some of the doubles get another member.
Yeah. I mean, you get that with the Laura Dern character. In the return, yep. I think it's cleaved three times, if I recall correctly. Yeah.
Yep. So what do you think happened to Cooper in the end, at the last part 18 and everything? What year is it? Like, okay, now what?
What's
your interpretation?
Yeah, I mean, it looks like the Demiurge, Judy, sent Cooper into a parallel dimension of some kind using electricity. Which of course has occult significance as well, but it looks like to me that the Demiurge, I guess the Demiurge would be Judy, the little monkey, the rhesus monkey, I believe it is.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And then I guess the Monad is the fireman, the giant, I suppose. But it looked like the Demiurge cast Cooper into an alternative dimension. That's what I got out of it. And again, you have, I believe at the end, if I recall correctly, the, like a bleed through, like a Mandela bleed through, where don't you when they pan up to the house before Cheryl Lee screams, Laura Palmer screams, don't you hear or see something in the house that triggers?
Oh, it flashes. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
And it goes dark.
You got like a parallel dimension bleeding through, or the original dimension, I guess it would be in that case. So, I mean, you know, when you're dealing with Lynch, I mean, the one thing that's always consistent is he obfuscates just for the sake of obfuscating. I mean, you can never come up with a complete rational. I mean, I guess in Blue Velvet you can, in The Elephant Man you can, but you get into some of this stuff like Twin Peaks, Lost Highway. I mean, it's impossible to fully piece together what he's going for, and he wants it.
Yeah, so, multiple solutions.
But I think we can say we've always suspected. But in episode 8, he does reveal his Gnosticism, because that's absolutely a complete Gnostic cosmology from the secret book of John, right?
Right. I mean, you've got that. I think it's called God of Light. And this is where, this is where you have, when you look at the TV show that aired on ABC and even Firewalk with Me, I mean, you have this great alchemical storyline. So it's not surprising that he goes this Gnostic theme, because, I mean, of course, the alchemists all took their ideas from the Gnostics, where you have, I mean, the Monad is the fireman. You have him emanating Sophia, which is, Laura.
Laura.
Yeah. I mean, you have, Cooper is sort of the Gnostic Christ. You have the fireman. What is it? The bums, the street people, as the archons.
Oh,
And I thought it was interesting, because I thought that it's interesting that he has the bums as the archons, because I thought, I thought back to Mulholland Drive. I thought, we have the bum behind Rupees.
The dumpster,
Is this an archon terrorizing Diane? Is Lynch trying to link the two universes, as it were? Which is another thing these filmmakers like to do. So, yeah, I mean, you do get, with that one episode of Twin Peaks, The Return, you finally get Lynch revealing the Gnostic cosmology behind Twin Peaks. I like the episode. I thought it was very good. I mean, what is it where Bob, I guess, is sort of the chief archon, gets emanated from the nuclear blast?
Yes.
Yeah. Good stuff. Good stuff there.
Yeah. Judy throws him up in the stream of garbage with all the eggs and the frog moth. Yeah.
Yeah.
Think, what do you think of the frog moth? What is he? What does the frog moth represent?
What was it? You have to refresh my memory.
Remember the kind of bug? It was a half of a frog in the back, and it was like a bug with wings in the front, and it was crawled across the desert. And
Is this the thing that gets into the mother?
Yes. Yeah. Crawls into her mouth when she's a little girl.
I guess it's that the mother is some sort of host to some sort of space creature, archon, monster of some kind. Strange.
Yep. Oh boy.
Yeah, and Lynch is so dualistic. He's straight out of Mani. I mean, every character is either on the side of light or completely on the side of darkness. There's no.
Of course, he blends them like a Jungian thing too, because the Cooper in the end, and at the end of the Return, he was kind of a blend between Mr. C and the old, vanilla Cooper, who's, the young one. He's kind of became realistic, quote unquote. He kind of integrated the two pieces.
Jung's individuation.
Yes.
Yes, indeed. All right. God, there's so many cool Gnostic films we could talk about. It almost seems we should have you on more than once, but why don't we get daring here? I'm going to first ask Rob, then I guess I'll ask Van so he has time to prepare. What would you say are the top five Gnostic movies, Rob? Your favorite or most influential? And again, I agree with all your movies, whether it's Metropolis, very Gnostic, Alice in Wonderland, classic Gnostic, Wizard of Oz. Vance has written articles on this. But what would you say for you? I'm going to assume Donnie Darko has to be there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, the number one, if you just wanted me to get into Gnostic movies and ones that I like, I mean, I guess for me, I guess the king of all the Gnostic films, I mean, it has to be The Matrix, the very first one. I mean, I guess from a Gnostic standpoint, especially from a Valentinus standpoint, I mean, that's got everything in it that you're looking for. I love Fight Club. I think that would be maybe, 1A up there. Of course, Donnie Darko would be up there. Metropolis, I think, has a lot of Gnostic overtones. I'm a fan of that movie. I always the other one that's up there. I like Dark City. I think that's an excellent movie for Gnosticism, and that actually is interesting because that actually uses the same set, some of them from The Matrix, the rooftop. Really?
Wow.
Yeah, and the hotel. It's the same. It's the same set from The Matrix. So I guess for me, number one and number two would be The Matrix and Fight Club. But there's so many good ones. Donnie Darko would be up there also. There's so many good ones. And those are always great movies to analyze. I think people really like them because it always involves an awakening to conscious and an identification of selfhood. And I think that resonates. I think that resonates with audiences.
Yeah, and because they're really documentaries too. I think people like documentaries. And speaking of Dark City, was it Alex Proyas? He obviously directed The Crow, I, Robot. So he's Knowing. I was wondering. Yeah, we don't know anything about him except he was born in Alexandria, Egypt. So a Greek guy born in Alexandria, Egypt is probably soaking in those ancient mysteries. So interesting to put that in. Well, Vance, what about you? Top five Gnostic movies that you
okay. Have? Well, Robert mentioned some of my favorites, so I'll mention some of the other ones he didn't, which is, I'm going to go way, way back, Forbidden Planet, which is a wonderful, wonderful movie based on Shakespeare's The Tempest, inner knowing, know thyself, right? Mother. We haven't mentioned Mother yet. Mother, fantastic. I love, there's so much symbolism in that. It's like a giant brain, right? And Constantine. I thought just Constantine was just very cool. With the corrupt angel. That was, hey, what more do you want for an archon, right? Tilda Swinton, the fantastic Tilda Swinton. Devil's Advocate. I like Devil's Advocate. That was very, very, very good. The Fountain. Of course, got to mention The Fountain.
Yeah, I was going to mention too, I'm sure all of us agree that if you want to talk about who's the most Gnostic director, we could talk Lynch, but Aronofsky's got to be the most Gnostic. I mean, every one of his movies is Gnostic.
Yeah, Lynch. Go ahead.
You know, Lynch isn't intentionally Gnostic, but I think Aronofsky might be. Lynch is just out there, He's dragging it up from the TM depths of the well. You know, this is the water and this is the well. I do TM and I bring it up swell.
And Vance is absolutely correct. I mean, Mother from a Gnostic standpoint, you know, again, is one of those movies, you know, you clearly have the Demiurge and Sophia identified, you know, and it's very symbolic movie.
I would say so too, and an excellent movie as well. Any other questions from the audience, Vance?
Well, let's see. Somebody wanted to talk about Spaceballs. That falls under the Star Wars. So anything you say for Star Wars, just turn it upside down. That's Spaceballs.
Yeah.
But they did have a good section of the Spaceballs where my favorite part of it is where they want to find out what's going to happen in the future. So they pop in Spaceballs, right? The movie into the VHS. They fast forward it. And all of a sudden they see themselves.
That was Mel Brooks has no problem breaking down the fourth wall or deconstructing his own movie.
That was good.
So.
Some people are saying The Neverending Story. Somebody mentioned that as a, and people like Dark City. I don't see a lot of questions. What did I miss? Yeah, I don't see anything right now.
Awesome. Well, I know I've got plenty. And of course, as you argue, Rob, the Star Wars universe might be just a simulation inside the Matrix, right?
Well, that's right. Yeah. You've got that that scene in at the beginning of Attack of the Clones, where you have, you know, you have all the actors from The Matrix turning up, the woman in red and Mouse right there. And you have the, you know, the red drink and the blue drink or whatever it is. So, yeah, I mean, I thought that was kind of interesting, as Luke is trying to tell us this is all a false simulation. Star Wars, a false reality. Interesting.
It is.
And Vanilla Sky, of course, talk about it's not quite the simulation, but I don't want to do any spoilers.
Well, no, that's got, you know, one of the ultimate 9/11 again images in it at the very end, where he jumps off the building in front of the World Trade Centers, for God's sakes.
Yep.
I mean, you can't help but think of those people falling off. And yeah, I mean, again, that's one of those false reality movies. What's real? What isn't? And I like that movie. I always thought, you know, it is kind of a depressing movie, downer.
Yeah.
If it were, you know, it's kind of like the one with Christopher Reeve. The one where
he's Somewhere in Time.
Somewhere in Time. Bid Time Return with the novel. Good movie, kind of a downer, though. So,
you know, Looney Tunes predicted 9/11. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but my son's into watching Looney Tunes. He's been buying all sorts of DVDs. And in one of the Looney Tunes, I think it's Bugs Bunny, says, "The towers, they're falling. And it's about New York. It's in New York. And it was during World War II or something. And the towers didn't even exist, but he was saying, "The towers, they're falling."
Oh, yeah. You could go back in time and find some really, you know, strange ones. I mean, there's the scene in Escape from New York, where they're flying the plane into Lower Manhattan. That's one. And then there's the one I was just watching the other day. I mean, it's kind of a bit of a stretch, but still kind of interesting, is Ghostbusters, where all the phantoms escape from the Ecto containment system, and they come swirling up, and you see the New York skyline with all the ghosts swirling around the Twin Towers from, you know, see it from Sigourney Weaver's standpoint. I thought that was always a little interesting. So, yeah, I mean, you know, you can go back in time with it. That's for certain. It gets escalated, though, as it gets closer to the event. That's irrefutable.
I have my own theory about the towers. I don't know if you've ever heard this one. I think it might have been a magical event, because in the 90s, there was a thing called Microsoft Flight Simulator. Mm-hmm. And it was very groundbreaking, and they had a New York City skyline. It was rather primitive, but you could recognize the buildings, including the Twin Towers. And one of the most favorite things people would do is they would fly into the towers with the plane in Microsoft Simulator.
Yeah, that's crazy.
If enough people did that.
You had the other one with the X-Files, which was the same year. It was like March of 2001.
Yeah, it was that year.
The lone gunman. Where the plane is hijacked and they're going to fly it into the World Trade Centers. And I like and then the Patriot from 2000 with Mel Gibson, where he makes the chair, and it's at the very beginning of the movie, and it weighs 9 pounds, 11 ounces, and he sits in it and it comes crumbling down, you know. So Take your pick. There's loads of them.
Yeah, it's an archetype, some sort of thing that print through on the tape of the simulation.
Yeah, and we were talking about the movie Parasite. Of course, if we're talking about Gnostic movies, we have to mention Snowpiercer. That's so overtly Gnostic. And of course, Ed Harris, again, plays the Demiurge in The Truman Show and Snowpiercer and in Westworld. So like I say, whoever has Ed Harris's agent must work for the Archons because he gets that same role.
The occult casting.
Yeah, they downgraded him to Adam in Mother. So
yes, you're right. You're correct. Yeah. Adam's such a loser in these Gnostic tales. We should, of course, mention the Lego Movie. That's another classic. And all these movies are dealt with very well, fascinating in your book. But what about, what genre would you consider? Oh, wait, Blade Runner 2, and Rob does a great job with Blade Runner 2049. But Pan's Labyrinth, Rob, what would you consider it? Categorize it as?
Well, that's like Del Toro, who is also expert with this stuff. That's his fairy tale. I see it as it's like an archetypal, fairy tale. I mean, you've got the ogre father, you've got the little girl who is obviously, an Alice in Wonderland analog. And I thought that movie was fantastic. There's the number three is all over the place in that. And that has to do with what's known as the rule of three, which you'll find all over the place in fairy tales. They just did one that came out. I think it was in 19, maybe it may have been 18. I think they reversed it. It was called, Hansel and Gretel? It was Gretel and Hansel. And that movie uses the rule of three all over the place. And I mean, who doesn't love Pan's Labyrinth? I mean, that's a great film, taking place in the Nazi Spain. Good stuff.
Yeah, definitely.
Stigmata is worth mentioning, right? Stigmata with the Gospel of Thomas featuring the sort of.
Yeah. I mean.
And then you get with that one. I mean, these filmmakers draw from a lot of source material when the little girl. Ophelia dies at the end and goes to the magical realm. I mean, she has the red shoes on again. This is the Alice in Wonderland, the Wizard of Oz, analogy going on. So, Pan's Labyrinth, fantastic movie.
Yeah, I would agree too. And probably none of his movies after that have that impressed me, believe it or not, whether it's, what's the name of that movie? Oh my God. Crimson Tide. I thought it was okay. It's Crimson Peak. Yeah, Crimson Tide. That's like the action movie. No, Crimson Peak was okay. Hellboy was okay. But I think The Shape of Water, he definitely seems to have catch it.
I liked Pacific Rim.
I love Pacific Rim, and the kids love it. Because it's
I like Crimson Peak. That's a remake of The Shining. The parallel between those movies is astounding. I like The Shape of Water in Baltimore, and that, of course, is set in Baltimore. And there's some interesting things going on. I think meant maybe for only people from Baltimore would pick up on that movie. Runs parallel with a movie made by John Waters called Hairspray. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about the musical one, the original one from like the 80s. They're set in the exact same time frame, those two movies. And that was a little interesting nod that I thought with John Waters there. But no, I like Del Toro. I like his films. I think he's pretty good. I like Pan's Labyrinth. I like Crimson Peak. I like Shape of Water. I thought Hellboy was okay. I never saw Pacific Rim, but I'll have to definitely check it out.
And there you have it, my beloved True Seekers. The first part of our AB Live with the most cool Robert Sullivan. The man has a third eye for the esoterica in the Babylon that is Hollywood. As a bonus for patrons, Red Circle members, and AB Prime members, as I mentioned in the intro, I'll include a section from our last Cinema Symbolism interview, where Robert took a deep dive into David Lynch, from his philosophy to his cinematic style. We also covered V for Vendetta and From Hell and other Alan Moore films, and also Freemason themes in Hollywood movies, and much more. Perfect compliment, and you won't want to miss it. Yes, heresy is really so much damn fun, especially when you're uncovering Hollywood. Including the audio version, this is a cool listen if you leverage the private RSS feed from AB Prime or Patreon or Red Circle that works in the podcast provider of your choice. And yes, speaking of Red Circle, you can now get a simple private RSS feed for less than $5 a month. Check it out in the show notes. So please become a member or patron or Red Circle subscriber for the full audio interview and to support this Red Pill Cafeteria. Go to thegodabovegod.com for means to assist and get the infernal rewards. Or just contact me. Whether it's Patreon or AB Prime or Red Circle, it will cost you about $1 per episode. And that's a deal of many lifetimes. The alternative spirituality and philosophy of the Gnostics is more important than ever. Might be the only way to counteract the nutsack grip Yaldibaldi has placed on the collective consciousness of humanity. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being yourself, your true self, here in the desert of the real.